Welcome to our program. I'm Richard Dugan as we journey across the Atlantic to Egypt. My guest is the author of I Am Happier to Know You. We'll find out about that wonderful phrase and how you get that started and her journey to Egypt and her newfound love and home. And also about yours, because we'll open up the phone lines here on Tell Me Your Story as we move forward, upward and onward, with new paradigms for a new world.
Walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Understanding. That's really what it is all about, and we're going to see what we can do about understanding better the peoples of other parts of the world, as well as other ideas, concepts, beliefs, cultural ways, etc. Here on Tell Me Your Story, we'd love to hear from you as we move through this wonderful adventure we call life. Our number here is 879-5478, 879-KIST. I'm Richard Dugan. My guest is the author of I Am Happier to Know You, and her name, of course, the author of this book is Jean Eck. And Jean, I'm happy to know you.
Thank you. I'm happier to know you also, Richard.
Now, you did something that many of us, I would have to say, only dream about. 6 years ago, you took a trip to a far-off land. I did the same thing in 2002, although it didn't turn out as of yet as yours did. You landed in Egypt, got off the plane, and as you describe it, literally put your feet on the ground and fell in love with the place, and you've been going back ever since and actually living there.
I felt as if I had come home. And as soon as my feet touched Egyptian soil, I heard these words flying through my head, and they said, "Welcome home, welcome home." And I had gone there as a tourist, and after that experience, I knew I had to return to live there.
You mean the voices in your head weren't saying, "What do you think you're doing? Go back to the United States where you belong"?
No, that was my family.
Oh, okay. sometimes you just want to get rid of family, don't you? Or not want to listen to them too much, because you do have to follow your dreams. Speaking of which, you know that dreams can change the moment. Fulfilling them can change the world. Your book is filled with proverbs, Egyptian proverbs, that I was skipping through the book and coming across a large number of them. A one-eyed man among blind men is the one with his eye wide open.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we can talk about some of these proverbs, maybe what they mean, but I'd like to find out about your journey, both from a practical standpoint, as well as just from an internal, emotional and spiritual standpoint. What did you have to do to, and I'm assuming that your residency is now 90% of the time in Egypt. How did you get that all together?
Well, after going there as a tourist, I came home, and I came home in November of 2000. And so I had to basically pack up my life. I owned a four-unit building, so I had to make arrangements to make sure all my tenants were taken care of while the building was for sale. I had to arrange online banking, everything that you could possibly imagine, you know, about your daily life, changing your mail, making sure somebody else could go through it for you.
Mm-hmm.
In case there were any emergencies, because basically I was blessed by having email, but that was my main means of communication when it worked.
Mm-hmm. So you couldn't have your snail mail, as we like to call it, just forwarded to your address in Egypt? That didn't work out?
No. The Egyptian Postal Service is not real good, and very often the mail is just, I guess, tossed aside if someone doesn't read English. I think once I received a piece of mail.
Oh, okay. And you raise a very interesting point as far as English. You also faced a number of hurdles because you don't speak the language, and you're also a woman in a Middle Eastern country that is, I guess, dominated by men?
It's predominantly Muslim, and Islam is more of a male oriented a religion, or I guess the Middle East is not Islam, but the Middle East is a more male oriented mm-hmm. and dominated culture.
I mean, we're hearing about a lot of the different cultural ways in which women have to dress, and many of them, you know, in many of the countries they can't drive. I don't know if they can vote in some of these countries, and so on and so forth. How did you go about the process of preventing yourself as a woman in Egypt from offending the sensibilities, if you will, of those in, around you there in Egypt?
Well, I inadvertently offended everyone at least once.
Okay.
But by keeping my ears open and watching and listening. And I was very blessed by having made good friends with my tour guides while I was there as a tourist. So when I came back to live in Egypt, they had found me a place to live. They picked me up at the airport. They stocked my little flat with essentials. And they took me shopping and basically explained the culture to me from the inside, which is was just a unique, wonderful opportunity.
Tell us about your overcoming the language barrier.
Well, what I did was I would write, one of my Egyptian friends would tell me a phrase, and or, you know, say, how to say left, how to say right, how to say straight ahead for a taxi. Those are crucial things I learned I needed to know, and how to give directions to get back to my flat. And you always use a landmark. So, Anna Isa Gam McDonald's. You know, I want to go to next to McDonald's, mm-hmm. Sherrod Tessa on Road 9. And so I had to learn that, and I would write these on 3x5 cards, and I would carry them with me constantly. Because if I could get to a landmark that everybody knew, I could then get home.
Mm, okay. So you've been living there on and off, if you will, again, I'd say 90% of the time since 2001, so 6 years. And what about your citizenship?
Well, I'm an American.
Okay. So you haven't taken Egyptian citizenship?
No, I won't. I'm an American, and that's fine, and I live overseas. And there are about 3 million of us worldwide who do.
How do you feel being outside of Egypt? As you described it, you heard the voices in your head saying, welcome home. Well, you're not there now. We're talking to you from Washington, D.C.
Correct.
How does it feel being away from home right now?
Well, I'm back to a different home. I'm back with family and friends and blue skies and Price Club.
Well, how about the holidays? What's different there than here?
Well, Christmas is, because it is not a Eastern Christian, those who are Christian, they're Coptic Christian, which means Egyptian Christian. And their Christmas is in January, as like with Eastern Orthodox religions. So Christmas is not a big deal. Thanksgiving is one of those situations where all the expats get together and have a lovely Thanksgiving dinner, as authentic as you can make it. But what happened to me was all my Egyptian friends said, oh, we have to have an American Thanksgiving and you're going to cook. So I did, and they eat everything that I make except for homemade bread, because they prefer the Arabic type bread.
Now, you actually traveled to Egypt in October of 2000 as the tourist, but it was in 2001 that you actually packed your bags. Is that right?
March 11th, 2001 is when I arrived in Egypt.
March 11th.
6 months before 9/11, yeah.
How were you in Egypt at that time of 9/11?
No, I was in Los Angeles with my youngest son when 9/11 happened, and that was my first visit back to the States.
How did that event impact your relating with those in Egypt? And again, obviously there's never been a connection with Egypt and this whole situation, but yet it's part of the Middle East, and there's always seems to be that tension between the U.S. and the Middle East, no matter what country that you mention. So was your relation strained at all with people in Egypt?
Well, first of all, as I was in the United States when it happened, and I started to watch some of the unkindness that was going on, and the fear-based hatred, it was very disconcerting to me and very sad. And then when I went home to Egypt, I went home late because I fell during a yoga class and dislocated my knee. So I arrived in Egypt on crutches. And everybody knew when I was supposed to be back in Egypt because they all asked me to shop for them. And so I arrived on Road 9 in Mahdi, which is a suburb of Cairo, and got out of the taxi cab on crutches. And all my little young friends who work in the shops on Road 9 where I bought my groceries came running out of the shop and they were so happy to see me, but they thought that I had been injured in what they called the war. And that's why I was on crutches.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty funny.
Mm.
But there was a lot of anger, a lot of sadness about 9/11, and a lot of discomfort. And then a lot of fear because of the things that were being said about Arabs and Muslims from the United States. And I think a lot of people were primarily afraid as well as saddened, because the majority of Egyptians I've met prior to 9/11 loved Americans. I've met many of them who have been tourists there.
So do you, living in Egypt and being at home there amongst the Egyptian people, does it hurt you when you hear those kinds of things?
Oh, of course. Of course. Because just like anybody else, I was raised in a family and in a community where what was told to me as a child, and I accepted as the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And we all do that. You know, we're all raised in certain boxes. And what living overseas has done for me has been to help me to reach outside my box and ask, is this true or is this not true? And, of course, the one wonderful way to do that is to live with people from different cultures and observe them yourself and make friends with them yourself and to see that, oh, my goodness, I really have been biased or I've really been uneducated. So I've had high government officials say to me, oh, well, you know, in Egypt they all wear veils and floor-length gowns, you know, burqas and abayas, and that's not the case at all.
Interesting.
So that makes me kind of question how much they know.
I find it fascinating as well because I grew up through and to the end of the Cold War, as it was described, and of course we were always hearing these stories about the Soviet people and the evilness and these types of issues,
mm-hmm.
when in fact it had nothing to, the people had no connection with the propaganda, if you will. Is that what you found here as far as the Egyptians are concerned in the Middle Eastern?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Every person in the world, we all share our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And I have traveled all around the world. And there are jerks everywhere. But the majority of the people, if you bother to talk to them, are wonderful, kind, and gentle.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true for the Middle East. There are jerks, but the majority of the people they want to live in peace. They want to feed their families. They want to have a roof over their heads. And they want to educate their children so that their children will have a better life than they had. Just what we want.
Exactly, exactly. I know that we ran into the same thing when we visited Ireland both times, my wife and I, when we flew over there. The friendliness, just the graciousness of the Irish people. When we were there, we were driving along one of the roads, and we had the turn signal on over there. They call it the indicator. And one of the people pulled up alongside us and kind of motioned us to pull over a little bit. And, "Are you lost? How can we help you?" And so on and so forth. And they gave us directions. Of course, our question just before we drove off was, "Well, how did you know we needed help?" "Well, your indicator light was on, and you were still going straight down the road." So they could see. I guess that's the international distress signal for help. But it's a wonderful thing. Because
they don't use them in Egypt.
Oh, they don't? Oh, okay. Well, there are a lot of folks here in the United States who don't use them either, and they're supposed to. I'd like to know which way you're going, and I want you to know which way I'm going. If you've just joined us, my guest is Jean Eck. She is the author of I Am Happier to Know You. I want to get to the root of that phrase in just a few moments. I want to let you know you're listening to Tell Me Your Story, and we'd like to be listening to you as well with your comments or questions. Our phone number here is 879-5478, 879-5478. That's KIST here in Santa Barbara. And, of course, this interview will be available following this broadcast up on the website, richarddugan.com. Just go to the schedules page and click on Listen to Interviews, and you're on your way to listening to the previous interviews, this program as well, and future interviews as we do them. I would like to send a hello out to Matt and all of the folks out at Island Seed and Feed. Thank you so much for your hospitality and community. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about as well, Gene, is your creating community, but also entering a community that's already sort of set.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are, this foreigner. And certainly you've already described that there is open arms is the best way to describe it. And you were, I guess, just assimilated right into the Egyptian culture in the area in which you chose to live in Cairo. Is that a fair assessment?
No.
Oh, it's not. So tell us, how were you?
I had to work hard because there were assumptions and prejudices about a Western woman's value in particular. Values. So I had these stereotypes to overcome, just as they had stereotypes to overcome that I held. And through conversations with my Egyptian friends who counseled me and whatever, I was able to overcome many of them. But there were times when I just couldn't. For example, I had a boab. A boab is a building guard, virtue protector, somebody who will run errands for you, and you pay him a certain amount a month. And my boab slept right up in front of my building at night with one eye open and on a hand-hewn bench. And he would be very worried about me if I wouldn't come out for a day, and he'd come knock on the door and say, you know, ask me if I was okay. But he was also very curious because I made friends with both men and women, and they would come to visit me. And it's not appropriate for an Egyptian woman to have a man come visit her without a family member there, particularly a father or a brother. And when you live in another society, you really have to decide what you feel comfortable doing that is appropriate within that culture and what you can't compromise on. And I could not compromise on not being around men and having male friends, Egyptian and foreign. So one day I lived on the ground floor and I had a garden off my flat, and I was sitting alone reading a book, and I looked up and there was Muhammad, my boab, with his face pressed up against the window, trying to see what I was doing. And it reminded me of my dog, Molly, who, when I took her to the vet, used to stick her head under my arm, and her bottom was hanging out, and she thought no one could see her. And then one time I was sick. No, I wasn't sick. I'm sorry. One time I had met this wonderful man who is a physician in Egypt, and he was providing me with a lot of information about the culture. And his father had been an Islamic judge, so he knew a lot about the holy book Quran and different ways that it's interpreted. So he came one day, and we had lunch together, and we were visiting, and he had driven. And in Egypt, as in, used to be in the United States, he had a doctor on his license plate. And everyone in the building thought I was ill because this doctor was with me. And so they were calling all my other Egyptian friends who were getting hysterical because they couldn't get through to me, and thought something was deathly wrong. And on one hand, I thought it was very nice that everyone was so concerned about me. But on the other hand, I was absolutely apoplectic that everybody was so nosy.
Well, you have been a professional journalist for over 30 years, and you're here obviously enlightening us as to your experiences. And I think that the one phrase that I used at the beginning of the program, dreams change the moment, fulfilling them changes the world, is very appropriate, especially for what you have accomplished and what you're continuing to do. It's not something that you've, it's not a finished work. This is ongoing. But it's an encouragement to the rest of us that if you want to live somewhere else, you're not being held by chains and shackles. Even if you have a job and all of these other encumbrances, there's nothing that says you can't do it.
That's exactly right. When you know in your heart that you're supposed to do it, that you have to do it, and go with it, everything works out perfectly. And you never know what you'll have missed if you don't do it.
And I often find it interesting about how, when you look at it from that perspective, what you could have accomplished if you'd gone down that particular road.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's right.
The people you would have met, the experiences you would have had, the laughter you would have shared, and even the tears from time to time, and I'm sure there have been a few of those as well. Have you ever been homesick while in Egypt?
I was homesick my first Thanksgiving. It was really, really hard. I was living in outside Alexandria, Egypt at that time, and I had adopted two cats, and I bought a roasted chicken, and the cats and I shared it, and I just cried through the whole meal.
Well, first of all, I like this. I can just imagine the scene of the two of you and your cats sharing that chicken. We have five now, and they're starting to share a little bit of our food as well. But I can remember my first Christmas away from home, literally in Ireland, and the first two, I think it was 2 days that we were there. My wife supported me incredibly because I was actually shocked at how disconnected I felt.
And sad,
homesick. Mm-hmm. But I told her, I says, no, we're not turning around and going back. I'm going to get through this so we can go forward and have a great time, which is exactly what we did. But that is an astounding experience in and of itself, to go through a holiday that you're familiar with, spending with family and friends. And even moving here to Santa Barbara, the first Thanksgiving that we spent here, which, of course, was last year, we had some family around us at that time, and it was very nice. But it wasn't quite the same, and it never is. And it isn't to say that, oh, gee, I wish I had been back in Phoenix. Not by a long shot. But you still have those emotions.
You do. But I've come to understand that everyone who's important to us, we carry them in our heart.
Mm.
And they're with us.
Yeah.
And as my youngest son says, Mom, holiday is not a holiday unless you're there. So it's just a regular day.
Yeah. And we just had a dear friend of ours who returned to Phoenix after visiting us for a few days. He may or may not move out here with us, but it was great to have him here, and he left last night. And we had a most wonderful evening last night. And where we live up on the hill, we love it when the fog rolls in. And that's exactly what happened last night. We're sitting there with a beautiful little fire, and we're sitting there chatting, and the fog is rolling in, and it's cool and it's damp. And it was just a great experience. What are some of those types of experiences that you have had that are, I don't know if I want to phrase it in the context of culturally acceptable, but what goes on inside your home? Does it stay in your home?
In what way?
In the sense that you can do the kinds of things in your home that you choose to, that you have that privacy. I don't know whether
of course.
The burqas out in public if you have to do that in Egypt.
No, women don't wear burqas.
Okay.
Most women do not wear burqas. They just dress modestly.
But you had mentioned about having I don't know if it was a taboo per se, but people were concerned about you having male friends over, whether they were American or Egyptian.
Right.
So that's there's a little touchiness on that subject. I mean, having the men visit you. So obviously there's a concern coming in.
No, I just made the decision that was something I could not compromise on.
I see.
And that I was just going to have to deal with the gossip. I did one time decide that I could get around it the way an Egyptian would, because I had finally come to understand part of how the culture worked.
Mm-hmm.
So my landlady's daughter-in-law and I were talking one day, and I had noticed that the Boab was treating me very coolly after my doctor friend left one day. So I went upstairs and I started talking to the landlady's daughter-in-law, who spoke very good English. And I said, oh, I'm so happy that Dr. M came to see me today, because he's giving me all this information about the Egyptian culture that I can write about. So she then told her mother-in-law and everybody else in the building that I was meeting with him on business, and the next time I walked past my Boab, he was all smiles. So I just did it indirectly the way they would.
Another thought that has come to my mind is the differences in living in the United States versus living in Egypt. Has the Western way of life been integrated into Egyptian life, or is there still enough of a difference between the two worlds, if you will, that you can tell them apart, or has Egypt embraced more of capitalism and democracy and just what you would find here in the United States?
Certainly there is a lot of rollover from the West, not just the United States, because expats from all over the world live in Egypt. And, of course, the Internet is making things difficult. One of my Egyptian friends said something very, very wise. He said, you know, it used to be after dinner, we would all sit together in the living room and talk and visit. The Egyptians always say visit. Or we'd watch television. He said, now with the Internet, the kids go into their bedroom and close the door, and they spend the whole night on the Internet, and that he misses the communication. So certainly the Internet is making a big difference, not only with its explicit material, but also affecting the family on a day-to-day basis.
I know that with my friend's arrival here, he brought with him the last vestiges of our belongings from the Phoenix area, so we are now officially completely moved to Santa Barbara. One of those items was a fire pit on wheels, and it's a small little thing. Well, we used to sit out in the backyard and have a small little fire in that fire pit, sit around with chairs in the grassy area, and have a glass of wine or whatever it is you wanted to drink, and just sit and talk. Mm-hmm. We hadn't done that since we'd been here. We did it for the first time last night, and it was one of those experiences like, wow, we really missed that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can certainly relate to this individual and their comments regarding that. I'm going to call it a loss. It's a loss of family connectedness, of community. And we don't have guests over. We have gatherings. And I love those. Those are a wonderful thing.
Well, in the Egyptian culture, the family is the most important thing, as it is in many other cultures in the world, not just Arab cultures. Family comes first. Family honor comes first. Protecting family members comes first. Providing for your family comes first. Much more so than in the West. You know, maybe that was true three generations ago here. But it's still true in Egypt.
I remember hearing a story regarding the United States and how that shifted, and it was predominantly due to the redesigning of the homes. The porches were made smaller and smaller and smaller.
You couldn't sit out and wave to your neighbors.
Yeah, and so you started to lose neighborhood and community. And that was one of the things we tried to restore, even at the home we lived in Phoenix. Kind of hard to do where we are now because we're rather out in a rural area, so your neighbors are a good distance off, but we still try to have people over in that kind of context. But that was one of the things that I had read about, and it is sad that that's happening. But are people, even in Egypt, are they working to make the effort to try to restore that in spite of all of the technological advances that we have?
Well, they spend, the men in particular, spend just an amazing amount of time in coffee shops having coffee or tea until the wee hours of the morning and talking. If you look out onto the roofs of the apartment buildings in Cairo, you'll see hundreds of thousands of satellite dishes. Egyptians are very much on top of the news worldwide, and they love to dissect things, and they talk about international policy and what's happening in the rest of the world. And that, and they also use this very strong male bonding, which can be very disconcerting for some Westerners, particularly men, because Egyptian men will very often walk down the street with their arms around each other or holding hands. And it's not a sign of homosexuality, but of friendship, because men are not allowed to show physical affection to their wives in public because it makes the woman look less than virtuous.
I see. So there is actually a sort of indirect appreciation and honoring of the woman through the lack of affection in public.
Yes, I mean, because women are held on a pedestal.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. And a lot of folks here in the United States and in the West, they wouldn't see it that way. They would see it more as, well, they don't have, women are second-class citizens. That's why all of these conditions.
Well, certainly I went through many warrior woman stages where I saw that, things that would drive me crazy. But in any culture, you have to take the whole culture. You can't just take a piece of it without understanding really what's going on. Some Egyptian women do feel as if they are discriminated against. Others don't. In Egypt, women are paid the same wage as a man. In the United States, we know that's not always true. Under Islamic law, anything a woman makes, she may keep in her name for herself. She doesn't have to share it with her husband.
Interesting.
That's
very
not
interesting.
True here.
You're right, exactly. If you've just joined us, my guest is Jean Eck. She's the author of I Am Happier to Know You. You're listening to Tell Me Your Story, and we'd love to hear from you if you'd like to call and talk to Jean, ask her some questions. It's kind of what I love to do is people can pick up your book and read it. But they may get to know you to a certain extent through the book, but I love the opportunity of getting to know you, the author, and letting the people know who you are and where you're from and what you're about that may not be in the book. And I think it's a little more personal, and it's a lot of fun to do, and we'd love to have you give us a call. 879-5478, 879-KIST is the number here. You can also send us an email, richard@richarddugan.com. That's richard@richarddugan.com. Feel free to give us a call when you get a chance to do that. And certainly let us know how you're doing. And also check out this radio programs that we have posted. This program will be available up on the website after the broadcast this morning. And we look forward to having you listen to the program again and share it with your friends and family. Maybe you'll get some ideas for fulfilling your dreams, changing the world, if it's only your world, but you're going to change the rest of the world too. That's one of the interesting things, Gene, that I love, as a kid, I loved the little game, the little handheld game called Sliding Tiles. And every time you moved one tile, you changed the board. In essence, that's what we're doing throughout our lives when we move forward to fulfill our dreams and our, maybe our destiny, if you will, our purpose. Once we make that first step, everything behind us kind of shifts, and everything in front of us shifts. So in reality, no matter what move you make, you're going to change the world. So why not do it on a more conscious basis and a more, oh, what's the word I want, desired basis, shall we say?
Yes, because when we find the place where we're supposed to be and the place where we can use our talents, we can then use those talents to serve others, and that's why we're all here. My work now is really about speaking around the world to people about different cultures and helping to create what I call peace through understanding our differences. When we value and understand our differences, we can't be afraid of them.
Yeah.
And fear is what is creating so much havoc in this world.
It's our greatest enemy.
Yeah.
I've often, I came to the realization some years ago that the worst time, so to speak, to have fear is at night. Because whatever it is that you're afraid of becomes enormous because there are no boundaries in the dark.
Right, right. That's a good point.
Yeah. You have put this together. How long did it take you to put this together?
Well, I'm happy to know you covered my first year in Egypt.
This is just 1 year.
That was just my first year.
Okay, and the other five books will be coming out.
I think I've pretty much said what I'm supposed to say, and I'm working on a couple of other books right now.
I love some of the proverbs that are in here. If a flower dies, it will keep its good smell.
Mm-hmm.
And what that says to me is if you keep to yourself all of the wonderful things that you have, your talents and your abilities and yourself and your conversation and your love, then guess what? You will, when you die, it goes with you.
There's nothing to leave behind, right?
No legacy.
And that's why I didn't do any interpretations of the Egyptian proverbs, because I felt that everybody should interpret them in their way.
Mm.
And that they also show the Egyptian sense of humor and the Egyptian wisdom.
I have to say that my dear friend who visited us just recently has just informed me that he has arrived home safe and sound, and I'm very happy to hear that. And it's one of those things where I remember 10 or 15 years ago when you took a trip, you waited and waited and waited for that person to arrive at their destination.
Uh-huh.
And then hopefully, you know, you could contact them, you'd make contact by phone primarily. And, oh, I'm fine, I made it home, everything, all is well. Did you run into any of those problems when you were traveling back and forth, or were you pretty much on the grid the whole time? You were technologically connected at every point along the way.
No, I wasn't technologically connected, but I would send my itinerary ahead to specific people, mostly my family,
mm-hmm.
so they would know what flight I was on and what time I would be expected to arrive. But no one ever read it or listened or remembered it. It always seemed to me. And then as soon as I got back to Egypt, I would email and say, I'm home. Everything's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that time, I didn't have an international mobile phone. So I couldn't just pick up the phone and call. And also the time difference.
Right, right. Up until 2001, when you moved, you packed everything up, and now your primary residence is in Egypt. Did you ever feel as though you didn't belong? There was something not quite right with being in the United States, that there was that longing to travel to find that home? Or, again, you felt at home because you had your family and friends here, and that was the connection?
No, I think the universe made it easy for me because I went through a very nasty divorce. And things were said that were not true. And so I began to feel as if I was no longer part of my community. And if that had, and it was terribly painful, but if it hadn't happened, I probably wouldn't have had the courage to go and explore and find a whole new way of life. So that's something that I would say to all your listeners. If you're going through a horrible time, and we've all been there, know that on the other side, there may be a wonderful reason for it. to make it easier for you to step outside your box and do something that you never would have considered doing before.
Hmm. Well, I would have to say that my wife and I have both had those experiences in recent times, in just the last few years, and it's very disconcerting when it's happening, and it's, of course, real obvious when it's over, because hindsight is always 20/20. But boy, from the other end, not in the middle, but from the other end, and you're looking down that long tunnel going, what am I getting myself into? Sometimes you just have to jump and trust.
And I looked at it very philosophically. I knew there was a reason for me to go. I had no idea what it was. But I figured, give yourself 6 months. If you don't like it, you've lost nothing. I put my house in the market. I was going to move to away from Washington, D.C. So it was like, you know, it's a win-win situation. What's the worst that can happen?
Hmm. Those are the items that we weighed as well. We stay in Phoenix. We don't sell the house. We get new jobs, and we stay in Phoenix. We move to Santa Barbara, and we have the same situation. We get jobs, and we stay in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like there was a huge, you know, difference in solving the problems, if you will, or addressing the issues that needed to be addressed. It was the same, so we figured, why not move to a place we'd like to really be, you know?
Exactly, and what a wonderful gift being jobless was, because you had no contact that you needed to maintain.
But it also taught us the lesson that we didn't need to wait for our jobs to be eliminated to make the changes, that we could have done it at any time and not
exactly
realized it.
Exactly.
But you also said something else, too, that the universe was telling you it was time.
That's right. And
there's a whole thing about timing.
That's right. Everything was falling in place. My life was a toilet that hadn't been flushed.
Oh, my.
And so everything fell apart.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to Egypt, I was more acutely aware of how unhappy my life was and that I needed to change it and I needed to find out what I was seeking. And so when I went there and I heard the words, welcome home, I knew I had come home for as long as it was supposed to be.
Hmm. It reminds me of a movie that came out some time ago. Shirley Valentine is the name of the movie, where the woman is living, I believe she's living in England. And finally she just buys a plane ticket to Greece for a short vacation and ends up staying.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so fascinating, the experiences that she has, just by virtue of, again, jumping and trusting.
Jumping, trusting, and arriving. I say, and I am happier to know you, that I arrived with childlike wonder and childlike eyes and virgin ears. I was open to everything around me. I was excited about everything around me. I was in awe of everything around me, which is not to say that I didn't go berserk once in a while and want to check into a hotel with padded walls, you know. To say otherwise would be a big lie.
Mm-hmm.
But by being open, and Egyptians so value kindness and smiles and warmth and friendliness, I was able to transcend so much just by being loving.
How are your relations with peoples of other parts of the Middle East? Has this experience, first of all, I should back that up and say, do you have interactions with other peoples from other parts of the Middle East, of the other countries, and has your experience living in Egypt for the last 6 years helped you bridge those gaps a little more easily now?
Oh, absolutely, because if I travel in other places in the Middle East, I am so open to the people. I am so so in awe of their culture and their kindness and their gentleness and their wonderful Gaelic-like sense of humor that it's just easy for me.
Hmm. Encouraging everybody to check out those longings within and see where they might take you. Or maybe not even concern yourself with where they might take you. Just go.
Just go.
Just go.
And something that might be helpful to your listeners is, years before I went to Egypt, I made a list of the things, and I call this my opening my basket of dreams. I made a list of the things that I'd always wanted to do, and I'd say, someday I will do X. So I made a list, and every year, just before my birthday, I would fulfill one of those. The first was to learn how to scuba dive. I signed up for an open water scuba diving certification class and did that. I had always wanted to be to do a community theater show, and I actually am quite embarrassed to admit this, but I did sing and dance in public.
Okay.
I'd always wanted to swim with dolphins, so one year I swam with dolphins, and seeing Egypt was on the bottom of my list of someday I will. Mm-hmm. That was my last one. And, you know, you can make all those things possible.
Yeah. And the reality is, here you are today, and you survived each one of those items on your list. And I'm sure you have a new list that you're working on as well.
I do. And it's a totally different list.
Mm-hmm. And you update it each year, and you cross off the ones. Matter of fact, my wife and I were going through some papers as we were unpacking. And we've been unpacking for about a year and a half now. And she came across this list of things that we had written down. And one of them, and it has to at least be a 4 or 5 year old list. I'm not sure how many years, but I know it's a number of years. And one of them was to move to Santa Barbara. It's like,
really?
Hello,
yeah.
We're
you
here.
You manifested it. That's what manifestation is all about.
Yeah.
And your listeners also might like to know that in addition to writing an award-winning book, I had no idea about writing.
Mm-hmm.
I met my husband, Chuck, an American in Cairo.
Really?
Yes.
Wait a minute. You had to go all the way to Egypt. The universe dragged you all the way to Egypt.
To meet my husband.
To meet your husband, who was already an American.
Yep.
And what was he doing there?
He was working there.
Okay.
He was working there. He's a geophysicist. He looks at the seismic data, in a nutshell, he looks at seismic data to determine if oil is in specific places where companies might want to drill.
Interesting.
And we had heard about each other for like 6 months, and it never manifested that we were going to, that we would meet, and then suddenly everything fell into place for him, and we did meet, and that was it. And we went, mutual friends invited us to a dinner party, and after dinner they insisted we dance, and Chuck and I went out on the balcony of their flat, like 20 stories up, overlooking the Nile, and he said, as soon as I stepped into his arms, he said, uh-oh, I'm in trouble.
I'm curious. I'd love to follow that story up and move forward on that, but I think that's a little more of your private life. Let me ask you about your book. Is it translated into the Egyptian language?
Arabic? No, it isn't yet. And my friends from around the, you know, from all the Arab nations to say, when are you going to do that?
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of time. I'm a little busy.
I understand. And I was just going to ask, you're a little busy, pardon me, you're a little busy in regards to what are you doing now? You're obviously, I mean, again, you have 30 years of journalism experience, and you've been, not only has your book been published and won a finalist in award competition, but also you've been published in the Washington Post and the Journal newspapers and the Living Fit magazine. What are you doing these days?
These days, I have been spending a lot of time on me, healing the parts of myself that are ready to be healed, number one. Number two, staying up with all the marketing that has to be done. On my website, IamHappierToKnowYou.com, we post new blogs every 2 weeks, doing all the business end of being a published author. Plus working on my next book.
And what is that?
Well, it's probably going to be Dear Little One.
Can you give us a little sneak peek at what that's going to be about?
It's about life and going on the journey and how to do it.
Step by step, in
ways that are understandable.
Well, we would love to have you back to talk about that. That's what this program is about.
I would love to come back. It's been so much fun.
I'm going to encourage our listeners to go to your website, which is, actually you have two websites, IamHappierToKnowYou.com, also GeneMEck.com. Now that's J-E-A-N-N-E, the letter M is in Mary, E-C-K.com. Or I'll make it easy on you. You go to my website, richarddugan.com. Go to the schedules page. Actually, you can go to the interviews page. You can listen to the shows. And there's a link to her website on my website. So you can get straight to GeneMEck.com through richarddugan.com. That's RichardDUGAN.com. And you can also email me. Love to hear from you. And I thank you all for going to the website and checking out the programs and the information that's available there. And we try to keep that updated on a regular basis. And Gene, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. I'd love to have you stay on the line before end the program. I wanted to also thank you for sharing the story through the book and through this program and your time. And you're heading back to Egypt within a few days, my guess is, to get back to your other home.
That's right.
Do you, when I'm working down in the city, and I'm doing what I love doing, that's a wonderful thing. If I could instantaneously teleport myself back up the hill to where we live and do that and avoid the transition of 20 or 30 minutes, I would love to do that. Do you long to be back in Egypt? Does the plane flight kind of drag on? I want to get home, want to get home, want to get home.
No, I just have become rather adverse to the thought of getting on another plane. I seem to spend half my life in the air.
Well, one day, I'm going to guess, based upon some of the programs I've seen on the Discovery Channel, they will have a train trestle going across the Atlantic.
That's going to be one heck of a long trestle.
It certainly is. But they'll find other ways. Maybe they will perfect the transporter. That would be a nice thing.
Or we need to learn how to do it with our luggage.
And it doesn't have to be checked. You just take it right with you.
Oh, wouldn't that be heaven?
And away you go.
And no security checkpoints.
That would be nice. And in this instance, you could either have your shoes on or take them off, and it's your choice, not due to security issues.
That's right.
So you have long-term plans on staying and living in Egypt, maintaining your U.S. Citizenship, and do you actually work in Egypt? Do they allow women there to work?
Well, it's not a matter of being a man or a woman. It's just having a work permit.
Okay. And are you working there, or are you actually having that opportunity to do the things that you described earlier?
Well, my husband is the breadwinner. I'm the one who's doing the long-term income.
I see. Well, it sounds like you're on the right track and on the road to that. And again, we do thank you for joining us. I am happier to know you. And that is actually, and I'm going to take a shot here, Gene, and I'm going to see if I can say this. Anna Assad.
Very close. Very close.
Good. How is it correctly pronounced?
Anna Assad.
Anna Assad. So it's a long.
Assad. It's really hard, and Egyptians or Arabs listening to this are probably laughing hysterically.
Well, as my wife loves, as my wife often has used the phrase, I'm glad that we're a source of amusement for you. And we hope that we've been a source of information and encouragement and enlightenment for you as well. To check out the website, GeneMEck.com, or you can also go to IamHappierToKnowYou.com. Check out the book. Check out the information. It's a portrait of Egypt, her people, faith, and culture viewed through the heart of a Western woman, and that woman is Jean M. Eck. She's been my guest here on the program. Jean, stay on the line as we come to the end of our program, and I encourage you to join us next week. We're going to have a lot of fun next Saturday as well. We're always having fun on this program, and it is a joy always to have our guests on. Next Saturday, we are going to have our guest returning, Joan Sibinski, although she's not going to be returning the way you might think. She's going to be bringing us Equinox. She is an unconscious channel who channels an entity called Equinox. And actually, it's not just one. We're not talking split personalities, but we'll save the explanations of that for next Saturday. Needless to say, we're going to take your phone calls. I've had the pleasure and the joy, both I and my wife, of experiencing Joan and Equinox over the last 7 or 8 years. It is a most extraordinary, enlightening, and loving experience, to say the least, and I hope that you will join us next Saturday from 11 to 12, 11 a.m. to 12 noon for Tell Me Your Story, when we will be talking with Equinox about the planet Earth, the living being Earth, and how is he, she, it feeling these days? How does he, she, it feel about us? And also, what's going on in our lives these days, and how can we make our lives better and more tranquil and find the things that we want? Tune in next Saturday. I'm Richard Dugan. Again, I thank you so much for joining us, and I thank my guest, Jean Eck, for joining us this Saturday. Have yourselves a wonderful week. Happy Thanksgiving to all, and love to love.